For KOSU, I'm Michael Cross, and it's time once again for This Week in Oklahoma Politics, along with Republican political consultant Neva Hill and ACLU Oklahoma Executive Director Ryan Kiesel. With just 3 weeks left in the legislative session, issues really came to a head on Wednesday as Governor Fallon told lawmakers to quit playing games and pass bills to raise revenue. Meanwhile, Democrats say they won't pay for any tax increase without a boost in the amount paid by oil and gas producers. Neva, the bill to raise taxes on gas and cigarettes failed to get a hearing on Wednesday.
And it's a mess. I mean, it's the mess that we've talked about all session long. And we really have even a tighter fuse on the timeline than the 3 weeks. I mean, they've really got a week left if they're going to have any revenue increases talked about. And I think everything in the House appears that the magic 76 number is really not going to be there for anything. So I think we're in this place where Republicans finally have to decide, are they really going to begin to strategically make these big cuts that some have talked about, but no one seems to have been willing to really kind of put the political capital on the line and get it done, or are they going to just cobble together and slash and cut and do whatever it takes to just get a budget, period? And at that point, I think the governor basically has said now publicly what has been said inside the Capitol for weeks, and that is, if I get this kind of a budget coming to my desk, I'm going to veto it and bring you folks back in, and we're going to start all over again. So it's a huge mess, and at this point, the contention not only inside both caucuses, Republicans and Democrats in the House, there's clearly a lot of consternation, and I think it's going to be very difficult to see who can bring these parties all together.
Ryan, this bill, but Democrats were opposed to raising any gas tax or paying or voting for gas tax, but also the bill seemed a little bit like a lot of log rolling, that it was a lot of different subjects in one bill.
Well, and that's right. You know, the weather may feel like February, but this is the end of May, folks. We got to get our stuff together, and if we're going to have these revenue bills, they're going to have to be real revenue bills. They shouldn't be susceptible to some challenge, whether that comes from some Republican or a Democratic or an independent senator or citizen after the legislative session is over with. And I don't know that Democrats are opposed to a fuel tax. I think that what Democrats are opposed to is a revenue package that seems one-sided right now. We're talking about the elimination of the standard deduction in the income tax, which, you know, there's some income tax changes right there, but that largely affects lower middle-income Oklahomans. The fuel tax is going to have a bigger disproportionate impact on middle-income, lower-income Oklahomans. The cigarette tax, again, middle-income, lower-income Oklahomans. I think these are all things that Democrats would be willing to consider if you had some income tax reform on the table as well. We were talking about, you know, raising the highest rate or creating a new bracket for upper-income earners in the state of Oklahoma, and then going back to the gross production tax and saying we've got to go back and recoup some of this money that we're essentially giving away to the wealthiest industry in the world. And if those aren't on the table, it's going to be very difficult to get to that 76 number. You know, Leslie Osborne, the chairman of appropriations in the House, has said, if you think that this is the last of the revenue bills you're going to see, then you're mistaken. Well, Democrats just can't go on that. I think that the Democratic caucus and the people of Oklahoma need to see a real blueprint for, you know, these revenue and these investment bills that are going to be coming up, so that they know what the actual revenue and investment picture is going to look like at the end of the day.
And I'd forgotten that until I covered the Democrats thing on Wednesday, that they can't raise any revenue in the final week of the legislative session.
That's right.
So it just means time is running out even more.
Well, and I think and then you compound the problem with these different arguments about what's good or what's bad that's being put on the table. And I think, you know, in the instance of the Democrats and the 6 cent increase in the fuel tax, saying that it was going to cost families $150 a year, and then you start really seeing all of this information come out that looks pretty compelling, that you would have to have an Oklahoma family drive a combined 50,000 miles a year annually to have this $150 tax impact. So I think everyone needs to quit being disingenuous. I mean, on the oil argument, on the gasoline hike, on all of these different components, and figure out a way to bring everybody to the table and everybody get a little of something. And I think, as you mentioned, Leslie Osborne, I mean, basically, you know, one of the things she said, which I think everyone would have to nod their head and agree, is that no one's going to like what comes out at the end. It's a question of what is the most palatable and best strategically overall to do what needs to be done for the majority of Oklahomans. And I think, you know, getting into this kind of class warfare mentality doesn't serve anyone well in this argument.
But you've got, you know, right now, not everybody's, you know, Representative Osborne can say not everybody's going to like what comes out at the end, but the folks that really like what's coming out of the end right now are Harold Hamm and some of the folks that at the upper income, these people that live in a different economic stratosphere than most Oklahomans, they right now, they're benefiting from the gross production tax, they're benefiting from the lower income tax, so they do like this. And what we're seeing right now is totally one-sided. I'm not sure, of course, do not speak for the Democratic caucus, but fuel tax is long overdue to be increased. Mm-hmm. You know, cigarette tax, and we can look at that and say, here are revenue and health benefits. But the impact that they're going to have, eliminating the standard deduction, you know, that may have a huge revenue impact on the state, especially if at the federal level, President Trump doubles what that is at the federal level. And so that's, you know, these are things that we should be, you know, taking a look at for a long-term revenue picture. But to say that we're going to do all of that, but we're not even going to have a hearing on gross production taxes or income tax increases, I think is disproportionate in terms of lower middle-income
Oklahomans. And I think there are a lot of other issues that could come to the forefront here at the end, whether they do or not, that have kind of been talked about probably more, I think, on the Senate side, I've heard, than on the House side, in terms of just concepts such as should the state of Oklahoma get out of having a state insurance, basically being the state insurance company and having an insurance business, where when you look at a lot of these numbers that are out there, the savings to the state could be $120 million. That's immediate. That's not some of these triggers that might come into effect down the road on some of these other ideas on the table that may not even evolve until 2018 or 19. These are immediate impacts. I mean, and even when you look at how that filters down to the school level, Oklahoma City Public Schools, you know, there's been some numbers I've seen that suggest that their savings on that change alone in the health, you know, the health side would be somewhere in the $50 to $60 million range in savings. So they've got to look at the big items. I mean, this idea that we're going to have a bill and it's going to save us $3 million or it's going to save us $7 million when you've got a billion-dollar hole, basically, doesn't work. And so I think they're going to have to be much more willing to come to the table with some bold initiatives, and whether or not they can get votes this late in the game, I think that remains to be seen how much leadership really wants to develop a consensus that we haven't seen so far.
And you mentioned the Senate. The Senate did actually pass a bill that cut ODOT $271 million, basically hoping that the gas tax would be passed. So it's... And now they say that bill will not be heard on House without any kind of a gas tax. So everything just seems to have stalled.
Well, and I think that, you know, we're headed towards a special session. I think it's difficult to imagine that we're going to get to a point at this late in the game where we're going to have the kind of revenues that come in to meet the kind of investments that the people of Oklahoma want their government to make. I mean, when we talk about taxes and we talk about revenues, what we're really talking about is our government investing in its people, investing in education, investing in infrastructure, investing in healthcare, investing in public safety, investing in our nursing homes. You know, these are investments that we're making as a collective group of Oklahomans through our state government. And, you know, where are we going to cut these investments? And can we make these cuts without them being catastrophic? I think the answer there is no. These are going to be catastrophic cuts unless the revenue comes in. I don't see us getting to a point where in the next week, whether it's through revenue or whether it's through, you know, your big reforms like Neva's talking about, where we can come up with enough money to cobble together a budget. And then even looking forward ahead to the next legislative session, which, you know, it's difficult to even imagine that. But legislators in the back of their mind right now shouldn't just be thinking about getting through this session.
Right.
It's, you know, what are we setting ourselves up for in the next legislative year?
And also, I think there was talk about if they do pass something, you know, a lot of times it's one time. So next year, you know, they could be $800, $900
Well, and it's the big ideas that maybe now are going to be actually kind of pushed to the table and have to be discussed. I mean, for Republicans, it's about, are there services, not core services, but are there parts of government that can really be trimmed? Can they be cut? Can they be privatized? Can they be changed? And is that something they're willing to put their political capital on the line to try to get done? May or may not happen. But it's those kind of ideas that I think the time has come to really put them forward. You know, and we're now hearing things like selling water to Texas back, you know, as one of those discussions. A $1.1 billion plan on the table. Tarrant County has said, you know, Oklahoma, you know, will not only put the money on the table, but we have we'll help build the infrastructure to get that done. Those are big ideas with big, you know,
have
big dollars attached to them. Now, is the public interested in that? Is the legislature? I don't know, but you're right, Ryan. I mean, the idea to just get through this year, knowing that you're going to come back in February in an election year, which is always on their mind, and have to deal with the budget with the kind of impasse that they continue to see. And frankly, the way the House is right now, the Senate really is now in a much more dominant position to be able to really dictate what ultimately happens in this scenario, much more so probably than the House, regrettably, from the House standpoint.
And again, it just feels like, and it's like this every year, but this year I think it was probably even worse. It feels like college students the night before a big test, what were they doing since February? That's what they said.
Well, not
all
just
we're
February.
Gonna focus
what have
on we been, is the budget this year.
What have we been doing for the last 8-10 years? I mean, the situation that we're in right now has been entirely predictable. And you know, there are a couple of remarkable things that have happened. You know, as former speaker Steve Lewis, who was our guest last week, he recently wrote a blog post where he said, you know, are we finally breaking free of this idea that we can't raise taxes in the state of Oklahoma? And there was this exchange on the House floor. Representative Earl Sears, the AMB chair, or the former AMB chair in the House, he was talking about a bill that would eliminate an income tax trigger that would save the state of Oklahoma hundreds of millions of dollars if to avoid that having come into effect. And the question was asked, is this, if income tax cuts are supposed to generate revenue, if we cut this, doesn't that mean that we're losing revenue? And he had to essentially admit that, well, wait a second, it hasn't generated the revenue like we said it would. And, you know, the first step to recovery is to admitting you've got a problem. Well, we've got a problem, and I think that we've admitted that right now. And hopefully, you know, we're beginning to correct path. And what I would suggest to the voters of Oklahoma, if you're listening to this and you've been out there voting for folks and creating this political dynamic that says that if you cut or if you raise taxes, we're going to vote against you. Instead of getting the pitchforks and going after folks that are cutting taxes or raising taxes, go get your pitchforks and go out there and stand next to them and protect them. Help them get reelected because they've got a tough job and they're going to need you come next November.
Last week was the deadline for bills to move out of the opposing chambers, and no teacher pay increase bill made it through. Lawmakers didn't seem too heartbroken over it, but Ryan, this was one of the two things they said they promised Oklahomans they would get done.
And well, it was a broken promise from the get-go. To start this legislative session, everybody wanted to go, because the teachers, they played such an important role in this November election cycle, and I think that what folks are realizing is that their political capital in the state of Oklahoma is only increasing. Education remains one of the most powerful political forces in Oklahoma. I think it's going to only increase going into each and every election cycle. Parents see government in action right there. You know, I think a lot of the stuff that we talk about when we talk about cuts to investment in Oklahoma, they're abstract, they're difficult to see. But if you're a parent and you've got a kid in a public school, you see these cuts on a very firsthand basis. So education is going to be powerful in each and every election cycle, especially as education keeps getting cut. So they want to go out and they want to help the teachers out, and they say, we're going to pass these raises. But to make that promise in this legislative session without revenue to back it up, I think was an empty political promise from the get-go. So this isn't a surprise.
House Speaker Charles McCall says there is still a possibility. I'm not sure exactly what that is, but
well,
he says
I think there are these folks that are holding out some hope that somehow in the mix of whatever deals are finally made and brought to bear that they can have some element of this teacher pay raise in the mix, so they can at least say that they've kind of started down that road. But I'm like Ryan. I think we're in a place where, you know, in the House they laid out this plan, they passed it 92-7 or whatever it was, but there was no funding mechanism. There was no real clear discussion about how they were going to build that scenario to get that done. And then I think they put themselves in an untenable position with the Senate, where the Senate could just, you know, punch a hole in it and say, you know, I mean, why would we be talking about something that you haven't even attached a funding mechanism to or really been serious about the discussion. I mean, the philosophical discussion on all of this is one thing. I mean, we can talk about big government, small government, tax increases, tax cuts, whatever. But at the end of the day, you've got to have specifics that you bring to the table. And that's where everyone is coming up short. I mean, they've got ideas, but no one can get the follow through to come up with a plan and then be able to work it through the process in the legislature. I think this notion that even in the House they've decided to have this kind of this stand against we are not going to do anything to bring Democrats across the aisle with those needed votes when they were talking about the 76 is ridiculous. I mean, there was a way to do something, but now the clock is the clock is working against them, and we'll just have to see whether they can they can do something to regroup very quickly.
And a lot of people voted against State Question 779 to raise teacher pay, right, saying that we'll let the lawmakers do it. Do you think some people out there might be regretting the no vote that they
made? Well, and I think that there are probably a lot of legislators out there that wanted 779 to fail that have buyer's remorse right now, because at the very least, regardless of what you think about, that way to pay for education or teacher pay raises in the state of Oklahoma, at least it was a dedicated revenue source. You had a funding source behind it. This is like telling your kids you're going to take them to Disney World, but not ever buying the plane tickets. And then, they're going to be really disappointed at the end of the day. And that's what, and, this last minute holdout of we may come up with something. I think that, teachers and their advocates at the Capitol need to be on guard, and I'm sure they are, for efforts that would say we're going to increase your pay over here, but we're going to cut benefits over here, it's this horse trading that I think that will make it look, if there is some sort of a pay raise for teachers, you got to look into the details to make sure that it's not taking something from robbing Peter to pay Paul, because at the end of the day they may be worse off.
And
than
all
they are
the
now.
More reason to have a comprehensive plan where there is the give and take, where everyone is really not happy, but everyone recognizes that this is the only good solution that they could come up with for this particular fiscal year.
An investigation over possible embezzlement of campaign funds forced the resignation of South Oklahoma City Republican Senator Kyle Loveless. Neva, were you surprised to hear about this?
No, the criminal investigation, there's been discussion that this has been underway since back in February. So, I think there was kind of this ongoing conversation, kind of in the background that there were, that there were problems that were being looked into. Timing is always a surprise, I think. Anytime you have someone come into the building and submit a resignation kind of ostensibly out of the blue and say that it's irrevocable and basically leave, it does have a stunning effect on the caucus, on the legislature in its entirety. And I think, unfortunately, it's been this kind of spiraling effect of where we're having multiple resignations, multiple changes this year, which has made for special elections, really, now that will go on through November, now that they've been set by the governor, particularly these last two, the death of Representative Broombaugh and the and this resignation by Kyle Loveless. It's a mess, and those things are outside the scope of what's going on in the building in terms of official legislative duties, but they all have an impact and certainly will have an impact as we look forward to the next election cycle.
Three senators over 2 years have resigned because of criminal investigations, Ryan. It's kind of a black eye for the body itself.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think that the institution has suffered as a result of it. I think it's unfortunate that Senator Loveless had to resign. I'm sure that, whatever calculation that he made in his mind, that this was the best choice for himself and for his family to be able to, fight the criminal charges against him. I think that in terms of process, we've got these two processes that are unfolding in at the same time. And I don't know that it's entirely helpful for institutional integrity. I think the first one, and the one that should be allowed to go forward first before there's ever any criminal prosecution, unless you have something that in this situation of Ralph Shorty, which is an entirely different situation, that didn't have anything to do with their elected office and them as an individual. But here you've got the Ethics Commission. We have a constitutional body, and for a bit there, one of the most recent past chairman, Lee Slater, whenever he took that position, what he said was you know, he wanted to see the Ethics Commission to be in a, not in a punitive mode, but in a compliance mode. He wanted people to feel like if they were out of compliance, that they could do what they needed to do, whether that's pay fines, restitution, whatever they need to do to get into compliance. And so that, you know, we can have faith that there's this system that helps people correct course. Now, if you get to a point in that investigation and their conclusions that there's been criminal activity like embezzlement, you know, the redirection of funds for personal gain, or to not even redirection, but the actual not reporting, taking them, put them right in your pocket, as the accusations are here, then you turn it over to the DA. But when we immediately turn these ethics investigations into criminal prosecutions, I think that it sends the wrong message to lawmakers that if you ever get crossways, the best thing to do is to dig in and or resign at some point if you can't get into compliance. You know, the mission of the Ethics Commission should be that the people of Oklahoma can look at the people that are running for office and have a sense of where their money's coming from and how they're spending their resources. And if we don't allow that to work itself out, I think that it's difficult to have a lot of faith in these institutions.
Well, one politician is leaving. A very famous name in Oklahoma politics returns. Edmondson, the former attorney general, makes it official. He's running for governor. Ryan, Drew Edmondson was getting a lot of pressure from the public to run.
Yeah, I think that Drew Edmondson walks into this. Yeah, he and Scott Inman, immediate front runners in the campaign. It's difficult to say who has the distinct advantage here. I think that, you know, Drew Edmondson walks in with the ability to, he has, you know, since his time as attorney general and his gubernatorial campaign, built a pretty progressive coalition around himself with his campaign against State Question 777. I think that there's a sense that he can probably begin to work with, you know, some of the Sanders coalition, the Bernie Sanders coalition that was very effective in Oklahoma during that Democratic primary. And he's going to, I think, distinguish himself somewhat, or at least, you know, this is my sense, that he'll begin to distinguish himself somewhat from Scott Inman, that they're probably going to be eye to eye on fiscal matters. You know, they're going to talk about taxes and investments and revenue in the same way, but where General Edmondson may be able to be more socially populist, you know, he you know, may position himself on things like reproductive rights, LGBTQ rights, criminal justice reform in a way that Scott Inman just simply hasn't whenever he's been in the legislature. You know, you've got Scott Inman, who has routinely voted against reproductive health care bills, or voted for them and against reproductive health care in the legislature. He's a pro-life Democrat. And we'll see how Drew Edmondson positions himself in this primary, whether he runs a little bit to the left to try to pick up some of those Democrats and independents that showed up for Bernie Sanders.
Edmondson also has he's known in eastern Oklahoma, which has been slowly turning more and more Republican. But they, I think, even how Republicans, Democrats would be certainly willing to vote for Drew Edmondson. They have for many, many years.
Well, I think that when you look at the primaries on both sides, like we've talked about, I mean, you have to begin to immediately handicap who the front runners are. And I agree with Ryan. I mean, you've got the minority leader Inman, and now you've got a former Attorney General Edmondson in the race. And there's they both bring some unique political capital and elements to the table. I think Drew Edmondson, you would have to say, given past history and given his strength of having already run a very broad-based campaign for governor and a very competitive primary, lost in a runoff, in a very close runoff, mm-hmm. but you have a situation where I think he has the ability to raise a lot of money, and this is certainly something that everyone looks at on the front end. I think the other thing is, when you look at how this sets up on both sides for Republicans and Democrats, I mean, you have a time in history where even though Hillary Clinton, you know, ran worse than anyone that was a Democratic nominee for president since 1972 with George McGovern in Oklahoma, you also have the history of since 1970, early in Republican administrations in the White House, Democrats have been successful in winning the governor's chair in Oklahoma. So to suggest that this is not going to be a very competitive climate in 2018, and I think for the Democrats, it will get down to how that nominee gets positioned coming out of their primary, just like the Republican will have to see if they can have appeal to be able to cross party lines. I mean, I think in some of the tone, I think in Drew Edmondson's announcement on Monday, I think there was this kind of broad-based appeal of trying to be not only populist and not only talk about things that he thought would resonate with voters, but clearly some attempt to kind of reach across the aisle and say, say, you know, whether you who you voted for president is not the issue, or kind of some of the less about the nationalizing of the campaign right up front, but trying to make it local and trying to talk about the issues. And he even went so far as to say, here's where I see a contrast with Connie Johnson. Here's where I see a contrast with Scott Inman. Here's where I see myself as being someone who can be a viable candidate and really speak to what the voters want to hear. So I think it's going to be a fascinating campaign. I think this is a campaign on both sides that will really be much more dictated about specifics and issues than kind of the generic philosophical kind of broad-based look that we've seen in so many recent elections.
During the Bush administration, 2002-2006 were huge years for the Democrats in the state of Oklahoma. Do you think that maybe this could be a big change?
Well, I think even more important than that is this idea that, you know, what we've seen over the last 8 years, essentially, and when the campaign comes up, 8 years of the Fallon administration, is a campaign that has been tied as an administration and a Republican Party that has been tied to just party discipline. You had Governor Fallon looking at, you know, the disastrous effects of not expanding Medicaid in the state of Oklahoma and what that's done. I mean, when we look at our budget hole right now, you know, we would be in a much better position if we had expanded Medicaid in the state of Oklahoma. Rural hospitals have closed, and people's health has been hurt very immediately as a result of this decision. You know, the budget hole that we find ourselves in, schools, roads, you know, there's a direct case to be made against Republican leadership in the state of Oklahoma. I think, you know, Democrats are going to make that, but I think at the same time, there are a lot of new folks that came to the Democratic Party during the presidential primary campaign, and they're going to want to see a candidate that isn't simply going to try to say, make that case on a fiscal issue. I mean, they want to know, you know, where do you stand on racial justice? Where do you stand on reproductive health care? Where do you stand on the environment?
It's the Bernie Sanders voters.
Yeah, where do you stand on earthquakes, man-made earthquakes? And I think that, you know, that's really going to be where the distinctions are made in these candidates. And if somebody doesn't, if you aren't able to do that, if Drew Edmondson and Scott Inman don't distinguish themselves from one another, and Connie Johnson isn't able to, you know, kind of raise the money, which, you know, that's the real question with Senator Johnson and her campaign is, you know, can she raise the money to be on a viable platform there and build the organization? You know, does somebody else step up and create that distinction?
You know, one thing's interesting, too. I think this will be the highest spending governor's race.
Oh,
I mean, everyone we see four years later, the next one tops that. But Drew Edmondson kind of laid down the gauntlet when he said that the Republican-led legislature essentially has been bought or sold out to the oil and gas industry, went so far as to say that, you know, that they're not following the law, that they're just, you know, they're following the law that they bought and paid for. They're not breaking the law. I mean, those were pretty. Were pretty strong words coming straight out of the box in an announcement text. So I think all bets are off in terms of how all of these quote special interest groups are going to weigh into these races and may weigh into them in the primary as opposed to wait to the general election a year from now.
And Democrats who, you know, like Scott Inman, who have thought things like, you know, voting for a Ten Commandments monument or reproductive health care things, they've thought that these are trivial issues. They may come back to be a major consequence in this primary.
Those issues always have consequence in their parties in the nominating, you know, the nominating process. I think then it becomes a whole different issue when you see who has really been, you know, who are the nominees for the Republicans and the Democrats, because then it becomes a much different picture on how to argue those points.
It's a lot easier to separate the two.
Right.
You're looking at fine-tuning when you go in the primary.
Right.
Ryan and Eva's comments do not necessarily reflect the views of the ACLU, KOSU, its staff, or management.